Parsha of Kisavo opens with the mitzvah of Bikurim, the first fruits that are brought to the Beis Hamikdash. And the way the Torah introduces the mitzvah is with words that we find not so infrequently, V'haya Kisavo el ha'aretz, and it will be when you come to the land. After all, the mitzvah of Bikurim only applies in the land. It's one of the mitzvahs hatzlius ba'aretz. So the introduction is appropriate. V'hayaki savo al ha'aretz. The Sifrei, the Medrash Halacha to Devarim, has a comment to make which will propel the mitzvah of Bikurim higher, perhaps, in our regard than it may have been until now. On the words V'haya kisavo el ha'aretz, says the Sifrei, Asei mitzvah ha'amura be'inyan, perform the mitzvah, which is mentioned in this section, Shebischara tikonis la'aretz, for in the merit of the mitzvah of Bikurim, you will be able to enter the land. That is to say, according to the Sifrei, the words Vahayaki Savala Aretz, linking the mitzvah of Bikurim with entering Eretz Yisrael, it's not only a chronological sequence, it's a causational sequence. That is to say, the entrance into the land hinges on the mitzvah of Bikurim. Of course, that itself is something of a paradox because the key to the door is inside when it's locked. In the sense that if you need the mitzvah of Bikurim to enter and you can only fulfill the mitzvah of Bikurim once you're there, so clearly what the Sifrei is saying is that when you bring Bikurim, you will retroactively justify your entry into Eretz Yisrael. Of course, you need to enter chronologically in order to bring the Bikurim, but in a sense, it's in the balance, in limbo, until the Bikurim are brought. And it's very interesting, I'm not sure if Mefarshim mentioned in this vein, but the first thing you declare when you bring the Bikurim, you say to the Kohen, Higadati ayom l'Hashem Elokecha, kivasi el ha'aretz, asher nishbar Hashem lo'aviseinu lo'aseis lanu. I've arrived, here I am. Now this could be someone who's actually born and never left Eretz Yisrael, and he's talking like he just got off the boat. Kivasi el ha'aretz, I've just arrived. According to the Sifrei, we well understand. Here is a person who has now, today, justified their either arrival or existence in Eretz Yisrael. Of course, this relationship needs to be examined. Because as we see, the mitzvah of Bikurim, to use the phrase very advisedly, is not, quote unquote, just a mitzvah. One of the 613, somehow it emerges as a key mitzvah, literally. It is a key to living in Eretz Yisrael. Of course, we need to understand how exactly it unlocks the land of Israel for us. But we should know that the matter does not stop there. For it takes us back literally to the very beginning. The Chumash, which begins, Bereishis bara Elokim, and as we know, to translate the word Bereishis as in the beginning is inaccurate for a simple reason, that the word Reishis means the beginning of. It is a construct form. We have a problem, of course, because the Pasuk begins in the beginning of and then doesn't say in the beginning of what. And it's disjointed, it seems. And that is why Rashi makes his famous comment, Ein ha-mikra hazeh omer elo darsheni. If you want to understand the most direct access to understanding these words is not through pshat, but through drash. It's quite a thing for Rashi to say. And Rashi's begun his perush, and his perush is dedicated to explaining the pshat and the pasuk. Ani dobasi elo lepshuta shel mikra. That's his mission. Pshat and the pasuk. Let's begin. Chapter 1, verse 1. Bereishis, says Rashi, oh no, Eina mikra zeh mela darsheini. We'll have to leave chapter for verse number 2. And indeed, Rashi does offer a pshat interpretation of the word bracious. It's much more complicated than the drash, for sure. But what does it mean, aderech hadrash? Well, the base no longer means in, but the base means for. A base can mean for, like vayavod Yaakov berachel. Yaakov works for Rachel. And bereishis therefore means for the reishis. That is, for the sake of the reishis, HaKadosh Baruch Hu created es ha-shamayim ves ha-aretz. Now, what is that reishis for whose sake Hashem created the world? Well, Rashi famously says, what is called reishis? Who is called reishis? The Torah is called reishis. Hashem kanani reishis darko. Yisrael are called reishis. Kodesh Yisrael Hashem. Reishis tevuah. So, and therefore, for the sake of the Jewish people and for the sake of the Torah, bereishis bara Elokim es ha-shamayim ves ha-aretz. That's Rashi's comment. But those are not the only two reishises. And indeed, the Medrash Rabbah says reishis. Rabbah, bereishis, bishvil bikurim, shenikru reishis. Where are the bikurim called reishis? In the second pasuk of this week's parsha, v'lokachta mereishis kol pri ha'adam. And therefore, this is another, to use the term advisedly, offering of the Medrash as to what is the reishis in the pasuk. And therefore, the mitzvah of Bikurim is just being propelled higher and higher. It began 10 minutes ago as a mitzvah, min hashura, amongst other mitzvahs. It then became the key to Eretz Yisrael and wasn't finished before it became the basis of the creation of the entire world. We of course, will need to understand how it is these things. What does all of this mean? As we know, we have three daily tefillos, Shacharis, Mincha, and Maariv, and there's a well-known discussion in the Talmud, in Maseches Brachos, in the beginning of the fourth perek, on Daf Kafav Amud Beis, as to what is the origins of these three tefillos. Do they originate with the Avos, Shacharis with Avraham, Mincha with Yitzhak, Maariv with Yaakov, or does it have its origins in the sacrificial service, the two daily tmidim, and then the burning of the korbanos? These are the two very well-known explanations of where the tefillahs come from. Avos tiknum, the Avos instituted them, or keneget tmidim tiknum, or do they parallel the daily korbanos? Lesser known is a third opinion, a third explanation, which is to be found in the Medrash Tanchuma, in the beginning of Parshas Kisavo. And it says as follows, Tzofa Moshe b'ruach HaKodesh. So Moshe sees with Ruach HaKodesh, v'ra'ah shebeis hamikdash osid lichorev. In time, the Beis HaMikdash would be destroyed. V'habikurim asidun liposik. There's no Beis HaMikdash, there's no Bikurim. So Bikurim would be discontinued. V'hiskin li Yisrael sheyu mispalalim shalosh pa'amim b'chol yom. And therefore, in order to counter the lack, the loss, the absence of the Bikurim, Moshe instituted the tefillos. Now, without getting into the question of how exactly this triangulates vis-a-vis the other explanations of the origins of the tefillos, we need to ask a couple of questions with regards to this Mishnah itself, this Medrash itself. The Medrash says that if there's no Beis HaMikdash, there's no Bikurim. That's true. But there's also no lots of other things. Everything that needs the Beis HaMikdash is missing if there's no Beis HaMikdash. So why does the Medrash zone in on the Bikurim as if to say, you know what it means if there's no Beis HaMikdash? That means there's no Bikurim. It does mean that, but it means it doesn't other things as well. Somehow, it's the absence of the Bikurim that is felt more keenly than anything else. And secondly, of course, if for whatever reason that is the case, we need to see how instituting daily tefillos in any way compensates for that, which clearly it does, according to the Medrash, because when Moshe saw the Bikurim would be discontinued, so his response to that was to institute daily tefillos. Somehow it is a response, but how? We don't talk about Bikurim in our tefillos at all. How does one approximate or compensate for the other? With regards to the mitzvah of Bikurim itself, as we know, the Bikurim are the first fruit. Is there any set amount of the crop or of the produce that one needs to bring? No, not on a din Torah level. Indeed, as we say every morning, Eile Dvarim She'ein Lahem Shi'ur, Hapeya V'Habikurim. Bikurim is on the list of things that She'ein Lahem Shi'ur. On a strict din Torah level, one could bring one fruit. There is no minimum. However, that is true on a din Torah level. The Rabbanon did institute a certain set amount, and that is 1/60th of the first fruits. There is a set amount. And interestingly, again, it's a din Rabbanon. It's not a Torah requirement. The Torah doesn't command the amount, but there is an allusion. And of course, we should not be surprised to see this. Having discussed in the past that the role of the Rabbanon is to try and, beyond what the Torah commands, to fathom what the Torah wants. So there are often allusions in the Torah that the Rabbanon respond to and pick up on and institute certain shiurim and takonos, etc. Well, where's the remez to the shiur of 1/60th? The Torah tells us, and it's interesting that the Torah makes a point of this, the Bikurim are to be placed specifically in a basket. The Pasuk says, second Pasuk, V'lokachta mereishis kol pri ha'adama, asher tavi mi'artzecha, asher Hashem Elokecha nosenach, v'samta batene. Now, tene is a basket, and the Torah insists that the Bikurim are to be brought in a basket. It's quite interesting. It's a detail that, if we would describe thematically what Bikurim are about, it may go undiscussed. But the Torah mentions it. And other things, the Torah doesn't say how you should bring it, but here it does. And the Balaturim comments. The word tene, if you consider it, has a gematria of 60. The tes is 9, the nun is 50, and the aleph is 1, altogether is 60. Says the Balaturim, tene begematria samach, this word tene has a numerical value of 60, remez lebikurim echad bisamach, that's the remez in the Torah, you've got to put it into a basket, that means that you've got to somehow network vis-a-vis the number 60, take 1/60th, V'lakach ne'elam samach b'parshas Bikurim. And it is for this reason, says the Balaturim, that the letter samach is missing from the section that deals with Bikurim. What he's referring to is the fact that every letter of the Aleph Beis features in the opening section of Parshas Kisova, with the exception of the letter samach. And now you know why. Well, of course, we don't know why. Because the entire discussion seems to have taken a curve. The beginning of the Balaturim is establishing how the letter Samach is such a significant letter, the number 60 is such a significant number with regards to Bikurim. It's so significant that it's not there. That doesn't seem to move in a straight line. We should imagine that it should be peppered with Samach, or at least have one. So how is its significance reflected in its absence? And lest we say that, well, you only notice it when it's not there, but between me and you, if the Balaturim hadn't pointed it out, none of us would have noticed it. So somehow the significance of the Samach comes in its absence. The Chol Zeh Omer Darsheni. And secondly, and I think this is an important question, which we see the Mefarshei HaMedrash are always looking to understand this aspect as well. You have a word, tene, and we note, by the way, that the Torah normally does not even use the word tene for a basket. It uses the word sal. The sal is not modern Hebrew. It's modern Hebrew because it comes from the Torah. Sal hamatzos. Sal is a basket. Shlosha saleh chori. So the Torah has actually gone out of its way to, it seems, shift the term that we use from sal to tene, so that the tene has a gematria of 60. And there's no samach that would be in sal. But the question is there any connection, essential connection, between the amount, namely a 60th, and the word of tene? Ultimately, we derive 1/60th, or at least we hear the signal of 1/60th, from tene. But seemingly, the two are not connected, essentially. In other words, the tene is the vessel that you bring it in. The 60th is the amount which you bring, and never the twain shall meet. I mean, they're not discussing the same thing at all. And it emerges a little bit external now. That you have this word that in its meaning it discusses one thing, and in terms of its message, its allusion, it tells you something else, and never the twain shall meet. Is that the case? So all of this, of course, I think we've asked enough questions certainly for now. And all of this brings us to consider the mitzvah of Bikurim itself. What can we say about it? We know the halachas and there's the masechta of Mishnayos about it, but if we're to understand thematically what the mitzvah is about, well, ultimately, it's about life in Eretz Yisrael. Life in Eretz Yisrael is not a simple matter. And by the way, whenever we talk about the difficulties of life in Eretz Yisrael, it's relative to life in the Midbar. It's not relative to life in Chutz La'aretz. All the difficulties of life in Eretz Yisrael are exponentially increased in Chutz La'aretz. So the focus of Eretz Yisrael is specifically in terms of the journey of Bnei Yisrael from the Midbar into Eretz Yisrael. And it's an atmospheric change. It's a categorical change. For in the Midbar, it's spiritual existence. It's the man. It's Moshe Rabbeinu. It's Anane HaKavod. All of a sudden, you enter Eretz Yisrael, and it's a different order of living altogether. It's the field. It's the vineyard. Ish tachas gefno. Ish tachas teinoso. And it presents its own challenges that we never had in the Midbar. Now, of course, ultimately, that's how it's meant to be. In other words, the moral of the story is not to go in. As difficult as it is, the punchline is not to stay outside. It is said by the Mefarshim that this was part of the philosophical or ideological platform of the Meraglim when they came back and they said, you know, we don't want to go into Eretz Canaan because we're either never or at least currently we're not ready for that type of physical existence. We should stay here. That was part of the idealism that went behind staying in the Midbar. It was a post facto idealism, but it sounded pretty convincing. Eretz ocheles yoshvehi, when they said the land consumes its inhabitants, says the Sfas Emes, that means involvement in the land will consume its inhabitants. Best to stay outside, doesn't that make sense? Or on a very basic level it does. But ultimately the goal is to take everything, the principles and the precepts absorbed in the Midbar and to live them in Eretz Yisrael. Now if anything was ever easier said than done, it's that. It's easy to talk about raising the land of Israel and raising physical existence. It's much harder to do it, because natural inertia causes a person to gravitate towards just perceiving natural causes and nothing beyond. That's the danger. The danger is that a person, there was no question, as long as we were in the Midbar, if anyone were to wonder, you know, where does our food come from? You just look up and it falls out of the sky, now you know. But as soon as it begins to come out of the ground, so it's no longer so simple, perhaps it came from the crops that I sowed and nature does its own, and this is the danger, that to go from being occupied in the land to preoccupied in the land, from being able to see a higher cause beyond the natural forces, or perhaps only to see those natural forces. This limited vision is represented and encapsulated of a natural order and nothing beyond that by the letter Samach. According to the Balei Machshava, every letter, I mean, the word for a letter is an os. oath means a letter, and it also means a sign, because every letter is a symbol, symbolizes a certain aspect of living, some higher, some lower. The samach represents a person who is, in a sense, trapped in the natural cycle, which doesn't end and doesn't begin, and it just came from last year and it's headed to this year, and that's pretty much all there is to say about it. And this is perceived in a number of ways. Of course, the shape of the samach itself is round, right? It represents something that's encircled, that's... And moreover, what's very interesting is the samach relates, it has a junior partner in the letter Vav. The samach, which is 60, is a macro 6. And the 6, of course, represents physical extension. Everything that's physical without any spiritual component is the letter 6. It's the 6 directions of extension. The sheishes yemei ha-maaseh before Shabbos comes in. So as a person moves from A to B, which is the straight line of the Vav, so any given transaction that is purely physical in nature is represented by the Vav, it's encapsulated by the 6. If a person has no higher vision, then all of those Vavs will essentially just lead him into a samach. That is to say, every step that he takes, every time he enters the office, every time he enters the field, if it's just within a natural way of looking at things and nothing higher, then in a sense he will end up pretty much where he started this time next year. And therefore, as surely as the Vav, the macro 6 is a 60, and the macro Vav is a samach, so the collection of straight lines end up as a circle, ultimately. Moreover, the Gemara tells us, it's a well-known principle, it's actually based in the Gemara, in Baba Kama, Daf Nun Hei, Amud Aleph, that many things feature in many different contexts in the Torah. But if you wish to arrive at the essential nature of anything in the Torah, consider where it made its first appearance, because that is where its essence is. The Gemara says this in a very specific context, for it states that if a person sees the letter Tes in a dream, it's a good sign, Siman Tov. Why is it a good sign? Says the Gemara, because the word Tov begins with Tes. To which the Gemara counters, well, you know, without putting too fine a point on it, the word Tumah also appears as it begins with the letter Tes. So as soon as you open up, you know, the dictionary under Tes, you win some and you lose some. Some are positive, some are negative. So how do you know that if you have to say yes or no, that it's positive, says the Gemara very simply. Yeah, Tes can be the beginning of many words, but the first time in the Torah there was ever a Tes was on the words Vayar Elokim Ki Tov. So its essence is fixed as positive. And therefore, with regards to our discussion of the samach, we need to consider where is the first samach in the Torah. And interestingly, the Medrash makes a point of discussing this. And moreover, it identifies for us the very first samach in the Torah, meaning with things generally, and the first samach with regards to human experience. It discusses both of them. The first samach at all in the Torah relates to those four rivers that came out from Eden, the Hayotzemi Eden, and each one goes in its own, whichever way that it goes. The first river is described in the Torah as Hu Hasovev Eskol Eretz HaChavila. It surrounds and envelops Eretz HaChavila. That is the first samach in the word sovev. And therefore the letter samach makes its initial appearance within the word sovev, which means to surround and envelop. Because that's the essential nature of what the samach represents, is someone who is surrounded by something and can't get out of it. Moreover, where is the first samach in human experience? Well, when Adam is put to sleep, and Chava is drawn out from him. So there was a bit of a wound there, which is not the way that the relationship should begin. And therefore it was closed up, says the Pasuk. Vayisgor basar tachtena. The samach in the word vayisgor basar tachtena, that wound was sealed up so that it's awkward. if Chava would look at Adam at a gaping wound, which is where she came from, best avoided. And therefore, Vayiskor Satachtena. But what's very interesting is that Samach has a similar theme. Because Chava actually is in an amazing situation. Because that wound was closed up, she could never tell where she came from. You look at it, you have no clue. And in a sense, what that means is the source of something. So if you would ask Chava where she came from, she couldn't tell you. And that samach also reinforces this idea of someone who can't see things from coming from where they actually come from. And therefore he ascribes other causes to them. So where does his parnasa come from? Does it come min hashamayim? That's closed up. He can't see that. He's in the samach. So he thinks it came from the seeds that he put in the ground, and there isn't any more to it than that. Therefore, when we come to consider acharei hadvarim ha'ele, the significance of the number 60 within the context of Bikurim, or the significance of the letter Samach within the context of Bikurim, so we understand that Samach is not an important letter in the linear sense of the word. Samach is the anti-letter of the Parsha of Bikurim. That is to say, Samach is what Bikurim is looking to break out of. And how does that happen? The mitzvah of Bikurim involves a person take those first fruits, which are really one's pride and joy. We've lost contact with that agricultural aspect of the land, but the first fruits that come out, I mean, lahavdil, anyone who has a tree in their garden, I mean, their joy knows no bounds when it, and anything grows from it. So someone who did their parnasa is from this produce, and the first that comes out, it's wonderful. Whatever they do with those first fruits will set the tone for how they relate to their produce. And therefore the Torah says, take those first fruits, because this is a critical time. It's a defining time. Bring them to the Beis HaMikdash. Give them to a Kohen and announce that you understand, in so doing, that your success in the field, this is where it came from. It came from HaKadosh Baruch Hu through the Beis HaMikdash. That's a statement. It's a fundamental statement, and it is an atmospheric statement for the way that will set the tone for when you go back to the field, it will stay with you. And therefore, the goal of Bikurim is not to stay within that circle, it's to break out of the circle. And thus, the formula is very specific for Bikurim. Echad misamach, one from 60. For isn't that what Bikurim is all about? Trying to find the one from within the 60, that is to say, the real source within the natural cycle as to where the Bikurim came from. And therefore, Samach is important. It's important that it shouldn't be in the Parsha, because that's what we're looking to break out of. So its significance is to be found in its absence. And this explains to us, apart from anything else, if we discuss for a moment Smichus Parshios, the flow of the topics of the Parshas, the beginning of Kisavo is Bikurim, and what does it follow from? Well, the very end of Parshas Kisetze, as we discussed last week, is Amalek. Maftir of Kisetze is Zachore is Asher Asolecha Amalek. That's very interesting. What type of flow is this? Ma inyan Bikurim Eitzel Amalek. I mean, that's really what we're asking. But the more we understand what Bikurim is about, we will appreciate that it is absolutely the antithesis of Amalek. For Amalek represents subjugation to the natural order of things. And there is no higher supervision, and they will be trapped in the Samach. And it's very interesting. We mentioned last week that in Parshas Beshalach, after the war, the initial battle with Amalek, the Pasuk says, Kiyod al Kes Ka. A hand on the throne of God. We spoke about the Yud and the He, which are the higher aspects, the higher emanations. Without the Vav and the He, that name is incomplete. But also the word Kisei is incomplete. It's written without the Aleph. In other words, it's a Kaf, which is an almost complete circle, which then turns into a Samach, which is a complete circle. And Kisei is to finish with an Aleph, that is to say, to observe the entire operation of the world and perceive the HaKadosh Baruch Hu within it. Amalek deletes the Aleph. There's nothing after the Samach. That's it. Kiseh becomes case as long as Amalek is here. And the very next words of the Torah are, when you come to Eretz Yisrael, be sure to take a stand and be sure to preserve your awareness about where your food comes from, and hence its Bikurim. So we certainly begin to appreciate, the more we look into the theme that lies within Bikurim, why it is that it's such a key mitzvah. Because the perspective that is carried with the mitzvah of Bikurim will determine whether or not we make a go of life in Eretz Yisrael, whether it's a positive spiritual experience, or whether it's devoid of spirituality. That depends on what you do with your Bikurim. And therefore the Sifrei says, remember to bring them, and remember what Bikurim are telling you if you wish to make a go of life in Eretz Yisrael, if you wish to justify your existence in Eretz Yisrael. And ultimately, not only life in Eretz Yisrael, but even Bereishis. The world itself is about bringing spirituality into the physical world. That's what the perspective of Bikurim. So now we understand, I think, to answer an earlier question, why the word that's the carrier for the 60 is the word tene, which is a basket. We noted the Torah never insists that something be brought in a specific vessel. And here, when it comes to Bikurim, it's got to be brought in a basket. How many things can you say about a basket? There's one defining characteristic. Namely, because the nature of a basket is that it's woven, it's possible to see through it. That is to say, any other vessel, if it's entirely sealed, so you can't see beyond it. And in a sense, that's really what Bikurim is looking to undo. And therefore, as surely as when something's in a basket, on the one hand, it is contained by the basket, but there is an angle and a vista to see through that beyond what is immediately containing it. That is exactly what Bikurim is about. The immediate answer as to where the harvest comes from, the immediately accessible answer is, well, it came from the seasons and the seeds and the rainfall, etc. and so forth. But Bikurim has to be placed in a basket. One has to be able to see beyond that. Who is guiding all of those forces? And therefore the Torah says, bring Bikurim in a basket. And because that's what's represented by the tenet, that's why the tenet is the carrier for the broken 60. The tenet is the carrier for the gematria of 60. Because it's the breaking up of the 60, which is really what the basket is all about. As soon as the person is able to see through the basket, they're able to break up that cycle, which is represented by the gematria of 10. So the mitzvah of Bikurim has a lot going for it. And there's a great deal to ponder. So much so, in fact, that it leaves us in an unfortunate situation. Because if it's such a key mitzvah and it represents so much, so what happens if we don't have Bikurim? Are we deprived and bereft of all of those sentiments, which are our key perspectives for life? Well, of course, on the one hand, there is no substitute for the real thing, or there is no substitute for Bikurim itself. But is there any compensation for Bikurim? And amazingly, the answer is yes. And the answer comes in the form of tefillah. The Ramchal, in the Sefer Derech Hashem, explains what tefillah is about, and it's a fascinating explanation, because the essence of what the Ramchal is saying is that the value and the purpose of tefillah is not contained within the time that a person is actually davening. And that's already a paradigm break. That is to say, perhaps if we appreciate that tefillah is important because one needs those times and to connect, and for all the other things that tefillah does. But the Ramchal says that one of the primary purposes of tefillah is not for the time that you're davening. It's for the time that follows. As if to say, imagine a person navigating this world with no sense of connection, to the divine, with no sense of being supervised or in any way guided. So such a person will founder. Such a person will become enmeshed in physical life. And what will become of his spiritual existence? It's doomed. To this end, says the Ramchal, HaKadosh Baruch Hu provided a concept, an institution which is called tefillah. And what is the value? How will it help? What's the benefit? Says the Ramchal, because at certain key times during the day, if a person checks in with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, then it allows him to align his perspective. And that's a perspective that will hopefully stay with him when he leaves Shul. The Gemara says in Brachos in the fifth perek, there's a mitzvah for a shul to have windows. Beis Hamikdash had windows. The pasuk makes a point of it, of describing it. And as a shul is a mikdash mat, a shul needs to have windows. Why is it so important for a shul to have windows? Just to have light. So Rav Kook says a shul needs to have windows because there has to be some type of contact, of transparency between what happens in the shul and what happens outside of the shul. If a shul didn't have windows, it would be segregated from the rest of life. And therefore, one enters shul, one davens, and as long as you're davening, everything is as it should be, but as soon as you leave, you can't even look back and see where you were. And there exists the danger that everything that a person thought of and felt and appreciated and understood during their tefillah will get left at the door as it's closed and there's no way back. To this end, says the Gemara, the shul needs to have windows. You need to be able to have some type of connection between life outside, life beyond, and life inside. Because the davening time inside, it's, apart from anything else, it's for the purpose of life outside, in order to give it the correct orientation. And in the words of the Ramchal, to quote two or three lines, Mashayaktim ha'odom, if a person preempts the Yiskarev and draws close the Amod Lefon of Yisbarach and stands before Hashem, Umimenu Yishal Kol Tzrachav, and he asks his needs from Hashem, which will remind him where his needs come from, and also will remind him why he's asking for them. If you ask HaKadosh Baruch Hu for Parnasa, you can't ask unless you have a legitimate need. So it causes a person to remind himself who his Parnasa comes from and why exactly he wants his Parnasa. V'yihyezeh reishis klali v'ikari l'kol ishtadluso. This is the beginning. This is his reishis. It's his reishis for that segment of the day. And of course, we cannot help but hear the resonance of the Ramchal describing a tefillah session, a tefillah experience as a reishis, as a beginning. That, of course, is a micro reverberation of the reishis of the Bikurim. As surely as Bikurim set the tone for the year, a tefillah sets the tone for the next time frame. And that perhaps this gives us a way of understanding what the Tanchuma said, that Moshe Rabbeinu instituted tefillah specifically when he saw that the Beis HaMikdash would be destroyed and the Bikurim would be discontinued. It was the lack of Bikurim that led to a lack of Reishis, and then what will become of people? And the answer to that, at least in part, the working answer is tefillah. The Reishis that is missing from Bikurim can be brought back in the form of tefillah. So these are some insights and perspectives into the mitzvah of Bikurim, and in a sense, it now comes off the page from Parshas Kisavo because we carry it with us, and certainly what it represents in our daily lives through tefillah. The rest of the parsha, or shall we say the most of the parsha, is the second tochacha. The first tochacha, as we know, is in the end of Vayikra, Parshas Bechukosai, and the second tochacha is here. And a very interesting question is raised by Mefarshim. It was asked to Rishonim. Because, of course, amongst the two tochachos, we cannot help but compare them and contrast them. And specifically, this question came out. Both tochachos have a similar format. They begin with the good news. If we do mitzvahs, good things will happen. They then proceed to the bad news, which is also part of the equation. Im lo tishma, that's the tochacha. But then what happens? Meaning, in Chumash Vayikra, the first Tochacha in Parshas Bechukosai, as much as there were dire predictions, but there was a good ending. There was ultimately a positive outcome. I mean, isn't that what the Tochacha is all about? As much as it says Vehevesi Aleichem, Cherev, and very, very difficult times, but the final psukim, I mean, the psukim that Mitzvah Hashem will say in the coming days, in Slichus, V'zochartu lahem, Bris Rishonim, I'll remember them. V'afkam zos b'yosom be'eretz oyveihem, lo ma'astim, v'lo galtim l'chalosam, they'll never be destroyed, Yeni Hashem elokei. In other words, the final section of the Tochacha is yet the positive outcome, ultimately. When we consider this week's Parsha, there is no such positive ending. It just ends in Perek Kavches Pasuk Samach Tes, where the Beis HaMikdash will be destroyed and the Jewish people go into Golus and they'll be sold as slaves and that's that. And no one would even want to buy them. I mean, that's right. V'smakartem sham lavodim l'shvachas vein kone. That's it. That's the final word. Eile divrei habris asher koras Moshe. So how can it be so different in the first Tochacha? We understand ultimately it's meant to be some form of elaboration, shall we say. I mean, this is of the first Tochacha. But in this respect, it differs. And this question was asked to the Radvaz, Rabbi David ben Zamra, in the Tshuvos, volume 2, number 769. And the Radvaz responds and says that actually the two Tochachas are the same. The problem with the question is that it stopped reading too early. And the reason why is because although the presentation of the Klolos ends in Perek Kavches in this week's Parsha, but if you move into next week's Parsha, you'll see that the follow-up to the Klolos is described there. And that's really what Devarim Perek Lamed is all about. Vayak yavo alecha kol advarim ha'ele, habracha v'haklala, v'ashivos alav avecha, v'chol agoyim eshadicha Hashem elokecha shama, and then, v'shavdat Hashem elokecha, then the Jewish people do tshuva, and then, as we know, v'shav Hashem elokecha shivuscha, v'chamecha, v'shav v'kibescha, v'yishivecha. So on the contrary, says the Radvaz, it could be that, in a sense, it was the limits of the reader who asked the question when he saw that the second Tochacha just ends in this week's Parsha and there's nothing else happens. Says Radvaz, it's actually spread out. The follow-up is to be found in next week's Parsha. And indeed, there are more psukim of Geula in next week's Parsha, more than there are in the first Tochacha. So there's your answer. That's the response of the Radvaz. It's interesting to note that the Panovich Rav Zatzal has a different response, and of course ultimately each one has its own contribution to the full picture. But should we ask the question, how can it be the two Tochachas, they're meant to be the same, they're meant to parallel each other, and one seems to end positively and the other has no such overt ending, at least within location, says the Panovich Rav, you need to understand that this is based on the key difference between the two Tochachas, which is pointed out by the Gemara. It comes, it's a product of the well-known halacha of Ein Mafsikin Beklolos. We do not interrupt the Tochacha. And what does that mean? It means we don't interrupt to give someone an aliyah. I mean, aside from the fact that, I mean, if you want to make someone leave the shul and start their own one, I mean, now you know how to do it. You call them up in the middle of the Tochacha. But we don't do that, right? Ein mafsikin beklolos. And the Tochacha is read all the way through. Doesn't stop for anything. There are other hanhogos with regards to the Tochacha. It's read somewhat quieter and somewhat quicker. It's always important that it shouldn't lose more than we gain. The goal of the Tochacha is it should be heard. But in any case, Ein mafsikin beklolos. Now, what's not so well known, because this is not the practice, but in principle, says the Gemara, you should know that the objectionable nature of interrupting the tochacha is only true for the first one in Vayikra. But if you wanted to interrupt in the second one for whatever reason, you can. It's okay. The question is, why is it okay? Why is it not okay the first time around? How did it become okay? I mean, it's the same thing. Says the Gemara, no, actually there's a couple of differences. And one of the differences that the Gemara points out is halalu beloshen rabim ne'emru. The first tochacha is said in the plural, both the positive and the negative. In b'chukosai teleichu, b'chukosai tim'osu, behevesi aleichem, eleichimachem. It's the plural. The tochacha in this week's parsha is in the singular, loshen yachid, im shamoa tishma, im lo tishma. It's all in the singular. And what the Gemara means to say is, therefore, that the catastrophic nature is much more magnified in the first tochacha because it's talking about everyone. The second tochacha has more of an emphasis on the individual, and therefore, for an individual, it's a tragedy. But for the nation, it's not the same magnitude. Hence, the problem of interrupting the tochacha, this terrible, terrible time, it's a problem much more for the first one, and as far as the Gemara is concerned, it is not a problem for the second one. For, as we said, no one does it, but that is, the difference remains true, characteristically. Says the Ponovitch Rav, I mean, it's a very bitter comment, but it's borne out by history, and much of which the Ponovitch Rav saw with his own eyes. So should you ask, why is it that the second tochacha doesn't have a positive ending, and the first one does? The answer is because it's only the Jewish people as a whole that are assured of a positive ending. The nation will never be destroyed. The Torah is not guaranteeing each and every individual over the course of the difficult times of the Jewish people that they will be a happy ending, because there isn't always. And therefore, if you understand the difference in nature, the difference in emphasis between the two tochachas, you'll understand why one is assured on location that everything ultimately will be okay. Individuals, everyone has their own experience. Not every individual is assured of the eternity of the Jewish people in terms of his own personal experience. Amazingly, there is a third answer to this question, and it's to be found in the Zohar HaKadosh, which I saw quoted, whereby if the question is, why is there no positive ending, at least within the parsha, to the second tochacha? According to the Zohar, there is. It's actually the final words of the tochacha. For the words are, again in Pasuk Samach Tes, you'll be thrown into galus, v'hismakartem sham le'eved, lavodim le'shvachos, ve'ein kone. You'll be sold, or v'hismakartem, actually is a reflexive, which is interesting because it doesn't say v'nimkartem, you will be sold. V'hismakartem means that you'll be selling yourselves. Ve'ein koneh, and no one will buy. Now, on the face of it, that's terrible. In other words, the only thing worse than trying to be sold as a slave is no one's even interested. I mean, that's just insult to injury. But it's not true. Says the Zohar, actually, it's the concluding bracha of the tochacha, as if to say, the only thing worse than what is being stated is if you wish to sell yourselves and you succeeded. Because if you did, you'd be sold into exile and the Jewish people would dissolve. The accompanying bracha of the tochacha is that wherever you will be, and sometimes it will be tough, but you will never fully be accepted. And that is an insurance of the continued existence of the Jewish people. The Ein Koneh, you may try and sell yourselves into and insinuate yourselves into the fabric of society so that you're indistinguishable from everyone else. The good news, says the Torah, is no one will buy you. That's good news. It may not feel like good news at the time, because there'll be quotas against you and there'll be glass ceilings, etc. and so forth. But that's the ultimate bracha, because when the time comes, there will be a Jewish people to speak of to come back. That's what they call in the vernacular tough love, whereby against perhaps our own instinct for self-distinction, HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, even if you wish to abdicate on that, you'll be kept intact, because ultimately your purpose is much greater. As the one of the Mefarshim once quipped, the Jewish people are meant to be mekadesh themselves and hold themselves sanctified. If they don't make kiddush, the other people make havdalah. So if it's not spontaneous from ourselves, HaKadosh Baruch Hu will arrange for it that nonetheless we remain distinct. The Mishnah tells us that there was a special takana. The timing of Kisavo is to read the second Tochacha just before Rosh Hashanah. Why? In the words of the Gemara, Kidei shetichle shana v'kilo seha, that as the year ends, the curses of the Tochacha should end with that year. So the year concludes, leave the curses behind in the year, and then look forward to positive things. Well, how exactly does this work? As if to say, the fact that we read the Tochacha at the end of the year, how is that meant to somehow indicate or augur well for us that the year will end? It's not an automatic thing. As the Mefarshim point out, as the year draws to an end, we look back, we take stock, hopefully, to consider the experiences of the year. Again, we're back to the Bikurim issue. We can either put it all down to natural forces, political, geopolitical, economic, etc. Or perhaps we can perceive a higher message. If we read the Tochacha, which is not pleasant reading, but if we read it, it may inspire us to see something more to our experiences. And if we see that, then we can hope to respond accordingly and leave the klolos behind as we leave the year behind. So this is really the perspective that has to accompany the reading of the Tochacha with Tichle Shalav Kinnor Seh. I'd just like to conclude with a word from the Haftorah, which we rarely get to. The final verse of the Haftorah, of course, these are the Shiva Dinechemta, these are the Haftorahs from Yeshaya, and the final Pasuk states, this is in Yeshaya Perek Samach, Pasuk Kafbeis, Hakato Yihyela Elef. Even someone who was small, he will expand, he will be 1,000. Hatzair Legoyatzum, even someone who's young, will become a great nation. The Jewish people will develop. Ani Hashem Bi'ito Achishenu, says the Novi, B'Shem Hashem, I am Hashem. In its time, I will hurry it. Bi'ito Achishenu. Now these words, which are famous words, Bi'ita Achishena, are first discussed for us in the Gemara, in Sanhedrin, the Tzadik Chesed Aleph, because actually they're a contradiction. Bi'ita means that it has a time. And whatever its time is, that's what it is. Achishena means I'll rush it. I'll hurry it up. But if it's hurried up before the time, which is a wonderful thing, but that's no longer the time. It's either Bi'ita, or it's Achishena, it's either at the time or before. And that is why the Gemara says there are two ways that the Geula can occur. There is a time beyond a final clearance, regardless of what will happen, largely or fundamentally. Says the Gemara, it depends on the state of the Jewish people. It can be brought forward at any time. Zochu, if the Jewish people merit, Achishena. So then it will take the route. These are two avenues of Geula. It will take the route of Achishena, of being brought to Hayom in Bekolo Tishma, can happen today. Achakolo Bechoyom Shayav, it can happen any day. Not just to say that any day could be the time. It could be brought forward to any day. Lo Zachu, if the Jewish people somehow do not rise and we have free will, anything can happen. So then there is a time beyond which it will not delay, and that's Bi'ita. So the Gemara deals with what seems to be the contradiction. Bi'ita and Achishena are a contradiction in terms. And indeed, they are two separate paths, depending on the merit of the Jewish people. The Radak, in his Perush to Yeshaya, he refers to Chazal, as often he does. He mentions the Gemara first, and then he offers his understanding al derech hapshat. And he says, V'yesh lefarish, again, we have this tension. How can it be hurried if it has a set time? It's either one or the other. Says the Radak, V'yesh lefarish, k'shiyagia ito, when the time comes, Achishena, I will hurry it, meaning legamra mehera, to finish it quickly. That is to say, what the Radak is saying is, The gula is not a point. It's not a moment. It's a process. It's a process that starts at a certain time, and it can have a certain duration. But some of the experiences of the gula are difficult experiences. I mean, there's wars involved, etc. And therefore, be'ito, when the time comes, achishena, the process will be speeded up. Not that the time will be brought forward. The time is the time, whenever that is. Or when whatever is judged as the time, achishena, the process will be expedited. Kilo yerach zman, there will not be a long time, me'es hechela Yeshua ad kalosa, from the time that the Yeshua process begins until when it ends. It's very interesting to note that according to the Vilna Gaon, in the Sefer Perush Haderes Eliyahu to Parshas Vezos HaBrocha, pardon me, Hazinu, this is what we refer to. It's fascinating to consider. Every day in the Kaddish, we say Yisgadal, Yisgadash, Shemer, but that's about the final Geula, when people will recognize HaKadosh Baruch Hu, V'chayeichon, V'yameichon, V'chaydechol Beis Yisrael, Ba'agala, U'bizman Kariv. What does Ba'agala mean? Quickly. What does Bizman Kariv mean? Short time. That's the same thing. Ba'agala, Bizman Kariv, quickly, short time. Those are two ways of saying the same thing. Says the Vilna Gaon, and it's echoing precisely the words of the Radak. The first request is Ba'agala. Let the moment of Geula happen soon. Ba'agala. And moreover, let the process of the Geula happen Bizman Kariv in rapid succession, one after the other. That's the combination of Ba'agala with Bizman Kariv. It's most interesting to note in the biography of Rav Aryeh Levin, that mentions that shortly after the Six-Day War, so someone, and of course, as soon as the Kotel became accessible again, which of course we forget that it had been inaccessible, that's not nice to talk about anymore, but Jews were once again able to daven at the Kotel, and someone was walking with Rav Aryeh Levin, and Rav Aryeh said, you know, we say Shir HaMalos, B'Shuv Hashem HaShiv HaSiyon Hayinu Kecholmi. When Hashem brings back Shiva Sion, those who return to Sion, it will be like a dream. How will it be like a dream? What does that mean? What will be like a dream? In Mefarshim differ, actually. What is the meaning of these words? We say them the whole time. Hayinu kechomim. Does it mean that the difficulties of the Golos will vanish as if it was a dream? Or does it mean that the experiences of the Geula will be so unbelievable, it will be like we're dreaming? Like the unimaginable happens in a dream. Said Rav Aryeh Levin, you know what's interesting about a dream? Is that when a person is dreaming, they can survey events that in real time would require a great deal of time. But within the context of their dream, all of this happens within a few moments, within a few seconds. What within the experience of the dreamer seems to be taking hours, in reality, is taking mere seconds. And that's the nature of a dream. And the pasuk is indicating that when the time for Geula comes, events that should have taken much, much longer, they will take on a dreamlike speed. And they will happen with such rapidity, relatively as if it was merely a few seconds. And he pointed to the events of that time. Wars don't take 6 days. It's just not done. And in front of us was a taste of the Geula, where something, and the more one looks into the details and the history, and it just boggles the imagination. A campaign that should have taken years, and halavai that it would have succeeded, it was just within 6 days. I mean, you barely have time to polish your bechers for the next Shabbos, and it's already the war is finished. Hayinu kechomim. That's a dreamlike state. And this is in a sense, an experience of Me'ein, Ba'agala v'zman kariv, and these are our hopes, Be'ita achishena, that the Geula begin soon, and that the process be quick, should be Be'ita achishena b'meher b'yamein.